indeed going to represent you in the proceedings before the Supreme Court, and our office is currently working on the preparation of your brief. There is nothing further for you to do," the letter said reassuringly, adding, "We will, of course, keep you posted as to the course of proceedings in the Supreme Court." On September 11th, Fortas sent Gideon a memorandum filed in the case. Gideon replied on September 16th, expressing his thanks and continuing, "Everything containing to my case is of the highest interest to me and everyone in the prison, and we will certainly welcome all the information about it that is possible. I wish that it was possible to tell you the truth about my case, which I am sure that the record does not show. I did not have the ability to cross-examine the witness, nor did I have anyone to investigate things before my trial, so my trial is far from the truth." A letter from Gideon on October 29th said, "I guess I am impatient, but it seems to take a long time, but I understand that something like this does. If there is any information that I might be able to give you that will help the case, I will give it." Perhaps that suggested an opening to Fortas. On October 31st, he replied, "Dear Mr. Gideon, I acknowledge receipt of your letter of October 29th. I can understand your impatience, but I am glad that you realize that a review by the Supreme Court of the United States takes a good deal of time. As you probably know, the review must be based upon the record in your case. I see no difficulty with the transcript of record, because your case will undoubtedly be decided on the very fundamental point as to whether the state of Florida was obliged to furnish you with counsel. However, as a matter of my own interest, I should be very glad to receive from you a careful and detailed biographical description, when and where you were born, education, employment, family, arrests, and any other information that may come to your mind. I want to emphasize that this is not at all necessary, and that it will serve only to give me a little background. I know that you will be extremely careful to be absolutely accurate in any information that you send along to me. Sincerely, Abe Fortas." On November 13th, there arrived in Fortas's office a 22-page letter from Gideon, once again printed in pencil on the lined prison forms. It read, in its entirety, as follows. "Mr. Abe Fortas, Esquire, 1229 19th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. Dear Sir, in answer to your letter of October 31st, I will try to give you a detailed biographical description of my life. You will understand that due to my limited education and also to the utter folly and hopelessness of parts of my life, it will be doubtful if I can put it down on paper with any reasonable comprehension. I will not be proud of this biography. It will be no cause of pride, nor will it be the absolute truth. I cannot remember or desire to remember that well. You have emphasized that this is not at all necessary, that you only want it for background. I believe that the state will attempt to use my personal record in their arguments to the Supreme Court, and for that reason you can be prepared. Also, being only a human being, I will try, though I know I cannot, to justify myself through this outline. I was born August 30th, 1910, in Hannibal, Missouri. My parents were Charles Roscoe Gideon and Virginia Gregory Gideon. My father died a few days after I was 3 years old. Mother remarried when I was 5 years old. My stepfather's name was Marion Francis Anderson. He died in 1955. Mother is still living. From this union, I have a half-sister, Mrs. Roy E. Ogden, 45 years old, RFD No. 1, Hannibal, Missouri. A half-brother, Sergeant Russell Lee Anderson, USAF. Mother resides at 2121 Chestnut Street, Hannibal, Missouri. My brother is 32 years of age. My early memory is of my mother's marriage and my stepfather. My stepfather was a good man, although he was uneducated and worked the largest part of his life in shoe factory, also my mother. We were a family of factory workers class, but always owned their own home, which my mother had first bought with my father's insurance. I went to the public school at Hannibal, Missouri. I never had any trouble and made my grades up to the 8th grade. My stepfather never could accept me, or I could not accept him. My mother was very strict, and my life as a child was of the strict discipline. My parents lived by the best moral customs and were members of the Calvary Baptist Church, Hannibal, Missouri, which I joined when I was about 13 years of age. My mother still to this day has done nothing that could be classed as wrong. Also, my sister and brother are of the best kind of character. I suppose I am what is called individualist, a person who will not conform. Anyway, my parents were always quarreling, and I would be the scapegoat of those quarrels. My life was miserable. I was never allowed to do the things of an ordinary boy. At the age of 14 years, I ran away from home. I accepted the life of a hobo and tramp in preference to my home. In a month or so, I made it to California. At this time, I began to learn the facts of life. How good people can be and how bad they can be. I wandered around over the West for almost a year and came back to Missouri. Went to my mother's brother and started living with him until my mother found out where I was at, and she came and got me. Had me placed in the jail at Hannibal, which I escaped from the next day, and went back to the country to hide out. At this time it was extremely cold weather, and a short time later I burglarized a country store for some clothes, which I was caught the next day by the store owner with all the clothes on. I was tried in juvenile court in Ralls County, Missouri. My mother asked the court to send me to the reformatory, which they did for a term of 3 years. Of all the prisons I have been in, that was the worst. I still have scar on my body from the whippings I received there. Anyway, I was paroled after a year. I was then 16 years old. Paroles did not mean much in those days. I went to work in the shoe factory at $2 a day, but was soon put on a piecework job where I made about $25 a week. I soon married a girl my own age and started a home of my own. We done very well together for better than a year, until I got without a job, and I committed some crimes in 1928. I was caught and through a court-appointed attorney was sentenced to the Missouri prison for 10 years for robbery, with 3 sentences of burglary and larceny running concurrently. I was 18 years of age at this time, and prisons were bad in those days. This prison had about 5,000 inmates at that time, and at the end of 3 years and 4 months, I was paroled. As I said before, paroles did not mean much then. When I was released, around the 6th of January, 1932, I was 22 years old. This was in the middle of the Depression years, and jobs just could not be found, even for experienced labor and trades. I know nothing but shoe factory, which I worked at in prison. I lived by my wits and only had one job in a shoe factory up to some time in later part of 1934, when I was arrested for stealing government property, to wit, a armory. I was tried in federal court and, on a plea of guilty, was sentenced to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas prison for a term of 3 years with a concurrent sentence of 3 years for conspiracy. I worked in shoe factory again. During this time, I saved a little money that I was paid by the prison. My parents had lost their home during the Depression, so I sent them my money to make a down payment on another place. I done a little over 2 years and was released on conditional release January 1937. There still were not any jobs, although the government was helping the people by this time. I was not entitled to any of this, because by this time I am an outcast. During the years of 1937 through 1940, I done the same as always, was arrested in Pike County, Missouri, sometime in later part of 1939, and escaped from jail, was arrested about a year later in Adrain County, Missouri, for the crime of burglary and larceny, was tried under the second offender law by a jury, and was found guilty, sentenced to state prison for a term of 10 years for burglary and 5 years for larceny, to run concurrently, admitted to prison December 31, 1940, escaped from prison in September of 1943. I falsified a personal record and draft card, went to work in train service as a brakeman, Southern Pacific Railroad in Houston, Texas. Worked there during the war, until October of 1944, when I was caught through the wanted list of the True Detective magazine, taken back to Missouri State, and stayed there until January of 1950 when I was released. Went back to Texas and started gambling, was married to Virgil Hoff in 1950, separated in 1951. Was arrested in Orange County, Texas in July of 1951, and on a plea of guilty was sentenced to the state prison for a term of 2 years. In about 13 months I was released. Went back to Orange, Texas to live. Worked as a cook on tugboat out of Orange, Texas, and gambled. Taken sick and broke down with tuberculosis of my right lung in April of 1953. Was hospitalized in the Marine Hospital, U.S. Public Health Service, at New Orleans, and received medical treatment for about 18 months in October of 1954, received surgery of a section of the upper lobe of my right lung. Left the hospital for Christmas of 1954. Went back to my mother's at Hannibal, Missouri, for a visit on New Year's Day of 1955, married Mrs. Velma Cooper of Hannibal. We went back to Orange, Texas to live. At this time, I had quite a lot of money, and I bought the Orange Domino Club there, a pool hall, dominoes and beer parlor. About 6 months later, I left my wife and sued her for divorce, which was granted 30 days later. In October 1955, I married my present wife, Ruth Ada Babineau. Ruth worked for me at this time, and I seen her beat down in a courtroom at Orange for the custody of her 2 boys, Ralph Babineau, who is now 13 years old, and Joe Babineau, who is now 12 years old. They were taken by their father, Sophistan Babineau, of Lake Charles, Louisiana. Ruth had a daughter, Donna Marie, who remained in her custody. Donna is now 7 years old. Later I married her, and taken Donna out of a foster home. I remember it cost me $80, and a short time after our marriage, I taken back the 2 boys. In July of 1956, my first boy was born, Ronald Earl Gideon, who is now 6 years old. At this time, I sold the Domino Club for $2,000 to Mr. Roy H. Stokes, who now lives at 501 Duval Street, Tallahassee, Florida. I went back to working tugboats and gambling. On December 31, 1957, my second boy was born, David Wayne Gideon, who is now almost 5 years old. I started another place of business in Orange sometime in 1957, which was never very successful. I worked most of the time then as a guard or watchman for the Orange Protective Association. I decided to leave Orange because my personal record was holding me down, so I came to Panama City, Florida. I went to work as an auto electric mechanic, and a month later my wife sold out the place in Orange, Texas, which was named Smitty's Bar, the same being my nickname which I received from my alias name when I worked on the railroad of Barney Adrian Smith. She brought the children and came to Panama City. At this time we had 5 children. I found that the standard of living and wages in Panama City was much lower than those of Texas, and I just barely could get by, so I started gambling again. I run afoul of a poker game, which was run by Mr. J.C. Tyndall of Springfield, Florida, which is adjoining Panama City, but has its own municipality. I believe that the only organized crime in this state is in this form, which consists of a mayor who is also judge, about 3 commissioners, a chief of police, and a night policeman. Anyway, J.C. Tyndall had been a commissioner, but was not at this time. He was running this poker game close by my house, and I am known as a mechanic in playing cards. I beat this game several times, the last time for about $150. This game was protected by the chief of police, a man by the name of Charlie Kitterell. I was arrested by him and charged with breaking and entering to commit a misdemeanor. This was July of 1959. I was placed in county jail, never given a hearing nor preliminary trial, and on 16th of September I went to trial without counsel. The court refused to give me counsel. There was only one witness ever to take the stand. That was J.C. Tyndall. The trial judge, the late Clay E. Lewis, stopped the trial and gave me a direct verdict of not guilty, with the district attorney asking the court to hold me so he might file further charges. The judge allowed him 3 days. After 5 days I was released after filing a petition for a writ of habeas corpus. J.C. Tyndall, a few months later, was arrested and convicted of transporting whiskey, was sentenced to 2 years by federal court to U.S. prison, Tallahassee, Florida. My youngest child and daughter was born April 30, 1959. So this left my wife with 6 children. During the time I am in jail, my wife went to work in a beer joint in order to feed the children because we were not entitled to welfare. Please bear in mind that this part of the country is in what is known as the Bible Belt. Practically everyone is a good Christian. There is a lot of churches. During my time in jail, the welfare department decided that my children were not being taken care of proper, which they were not. They taken the children and placed them in foster homes. My wife broke over this and started to drink, and I don't think she ever got over it. When I was released from jail, I went back to work that day as an auto electric mechanic on commission basis. I hunted up my wife and went to the welfare and got my children. But my wife was too far gone to straighten out, and I could get no help from the social workers. Once hearing a wise old doctor say that the best thing for a poor person who did not have the money to hire psychiatry, the best thing is to send them to church. So I decided to use the church. I do not like the idea of forcing my children or enticing them to believe in any certain religion, but I have always wanted them to learn the moral respect that the people of this country has, and of all the great religions, I have picked the Christian religion because it is based on love. So, in my desperation, I pick a Baptist church because that had been my church when I was a little boy. Now I class that organization in the same class as I do the KKK, because they hate too many persons and things. Anyway, for the want of something better, I took this way. I started every Sunday morning of dressing the children and myself up and going to the Cedar Grove Baptist Church at Cedar Grove, Florida, another one of those little municipalities I mentioned before. I believe it is listed as one of the worst speed traps not to even be on a major highway by the AAA. The people of the church accepted my children with all their heart, but me they just tolerated, 'cause they were mine. My strategy worked. My wife decided to go to church with us, so I bought her some new clothes and she took a big interest in everything. About this time I took down sick with a terrible pain in my chest. Having no money, I went to the county clinic for an X-ray and later went to the welfare, the family service of Panama City. They would not help, but sent me to the hospital, and the doctor on duty, Dr. Webb, sent me back to the county clinic for sputum test. At this time, the family service paid my rent. The first sputum test that went to the hospital at Tallahassee, Florida, the W.T. Edwards Hospital. Came back positive. The county nurse was there next day asking me to sign papers to go to the hospital at Tallahassee, which I did. I did not work no more, nor did I go to church any more. The welfare, or rather the family service, gave us $10 a week then, and until I went to the hospital, which was December 31, 1959. My wife's interest in the church had matured to the point that when I went to hospital, the church was practicable taking care of my family. But did you ever try to take care of 6 children on a bill for $10 in groceries? I sent my wife to the Department of Public Welfare, and they said they would investigate, which after a time, a month or two, they said they could not pay my family the American child support, which in this state is only $81 a month. They rejected it on account of my record, of course, my wife's too. Now most of this money comes to the states to be administered by them, but there is restrictions on not giving it to needy children. I don't know for sure, but I can find out and I will. that most of the dollar that comes to this state goes to the cost of administration and not to needy children. In the meantime, the church is helping to take care of the children, and after 3 months of examinations, the staff of doctors diagnosed my trouble as atypical tuberculosis. That there was an infection in my lung, and I would have to have surgery. Remember, I had surgery before, and I hated to take it again, but I signed for it. I am treated the best of kind in this hospital, anything I want, chicken every day. Can you imagine how I felt every time I ate my meals of steak and chicken when I would think of my children, hoping they had anything at all? After more examinations, I was put to surgery by a master doctor, but I still hardly made it. After about 2 months, I began to get better. My wife had quit writing to me, and I heard through different sources that she had quit the church and started back to drinking. I left the hospital and went home, and the stories I had heard were true. My wife was working in a jute joint, and the children were taking care of theirself. My wife was living with another man, and after the fight and everything. They had me arrested, but failed to press charges against me, so the county hung a drunk charge on me. Rather than stay in jail, I had a friend pay my fine, and I went back to hospital, which I left before very long against medical advice. I went to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where I had friends, and went to work. I sent my wife $20 a week for the children. At this time I was a very unhappy man, and I had been hooked on drugs during my surgery and recovery, which I know now affected me then. After about a month and a half, I received one of my money orders back. I was cooking on a spud barge, and we were down in the swamps at Golden Meadows, Louisiana, then. I called the officer of the juvenile court in Panama City and asked him about my children. He told me that the court had the children, but he did not know about my wife. So I made arrangements to go to Panama City the next day. I went to the public welfare and learnt that my wife had given up the children to them and had gotten herself arrested for drunken driving at Blounston, Florida, and had been in jail for about 30 days, but was out then. Also, she had received 3 of my money orders and spent them. I recovered 3, which I give to the welfare department. I went and visit the children and contacted my wife, so I left her alone. I made a deal with the welfare department to pay them $180 a month or $45 a week. I went back to Louisiana and went to work. I worked another month and a half and was let go on account of the health department. Because I left the hospital against medical advice, they had turned me into the Louisiana Health Department. I came back to Panama City and attempted to make a living by gambling. About then, I found out my wife was pregnant. Sometime in January, I was with a friend of mine, Sergeant H. Stickell, on Tyndall Air Force Base. I had been living at his home for about a month. We were building a club for squad service there, when out of the blue sky I was arrested one day. He was with me, by the FBI office, sheriff's office, and the city detectives of Panama City. Also they searched St. Stickell's home. I was not locked up. There had been a burglary of the armory in Panama City. So for no reason except that 25 years before, I had robbed one. I was still sick and could not make any money. My wife had her baby through one of those professional dealers in little children, also through the public welfare of Panama City. It seems to me that they approve of a woman doing that way. Anyway, they all wanted me to sign the adoption papers for the baby, which I did. I was not very happy about the whole thing. By this time I realized that I would never be able to live with my wife and make a home for my children, and I started to make arrangement to have my sister and mother take my children, and to get a divorce from my wife. A short time later I was arrested one night in my bed at the hotel I lived in, for no reason at all, for investigation and vagrancy. Investigation of a $2,000 robbery of the Bay Harbor Bar, which was across the street from where I lived. After 2 weeks in jail, they put a charge of vagrancy against me, a set bond at $200. In 4 more days I was arraigned in county court, and plead not guilty, and was turned loose. The public welfare seemed surprised. About a month later, on June 3, 1961, I was arrested for the crime I am now doing time on. I was charged with breaking and entering to commit a misdemeanor and was convicted in a trial August 4, 1961, sentenced to state prison August 27, 1961. This charge growed out of gambling and was very near similar to the charge I was tried on before in Panama City. I worked in this place and did run a poker game there. About a month before, the sheriff had been suspended by the governor, Mr. Doc Daffin. In the last election, he was elected back to the office and will be back in for a 4-year term beginning the first of the year. I did not break into this building, nor did I have to. I had the keys to the building, and if the building was broke into, it was done by one of the parties involved. A short time before, Ira Strickland and I had a falling out over a poker game he was supposed to fix with the sheriff in Washington County. There is a dog racing track at Ebo, a short ways from Panama City, and his sister has a sort of motel there. He failed to do it, and with the investigation going on in Panama City, I closed the game there, which was not making any money. The state witness, Cook, who was supposed to identify me, had a bad police record, and the court would not let me bring that out. Nor that one time I had at the point of a pistol made him stop beating a girl. I always believed that the primarily reason of trial in a court of law was to reach the truth. My trial was far from the truth. One day, when I was being arraigned, I seen 2 trials of 2 different men tried without attorneys. 1 hour from the time they started, they had 2 juries out, and 15 minutes later they were found guilty and sentenced. Is this a fair trial? This is common practice through most of this state. This penitentiary is full of men who are here with 5 years for petty larceny, drunk and minor sex crimes. Of course, this is the Bible Belt, and the customs here are a lot higher degree of morals. I am a electrician here, and one of my fellow workers has 2 years for drunk and resisting arrest. Most city police courts would give a citizen a $25 fine for the same charge. He was tried without an attorney and convicted. This week he is filing a petition to the U.S. Supreme Court for a writ of certiorari to review a writ of habeas corpus. This state still runs their courts on the principle of the common law. And there are actual cases here now of citizens who have sentenced with no statutes covering the charges. The Supreme Court at Florida handed down a ruling last month involving the rights of man to have charges put against him within a reasonable time. This man was held for about 3 weeks before being charged. They upheld the lower courts, 1 justice dissenting. They said that it was right, that that was the law, but this is different. What it amounted to, anyway. The 1 justices said that these laws were not made in jest. The dissenting vote. There was not a crime committed in my case, and I don't feel like I had a fair trial. If I had a attorney, he could brought out all of these things in my trial. When I was arrested, I was put in solitary confinement, and I was not allowed the papers, not to use the telephone, or to write to everyone I should. I did get a speedy arraignment and preliminary trial at my arraignment in circuit court. I was allowed more time to try and obtain an attorney, which I could not do. You know about the rest of my trial. I have had no trouble since I have been here. I have worked as an electrician ever since I have been here, and for the last year I received 60 days extra gain time. This prison is all right, as for prison. Probably the best in the South. Outside of proper medical care, I have a lung condition, but have never been able to see a doctor. But that is the way prisons are. The doctors are never the best anyway. I think I should be receiving medication for my lungs. I was when I came in here. My sister and mother refused to take my children, and I have never written to them since I have been here. I did write to the welfare department in Panama City about my children. They, through the juvenile court in Panama City, did try to do me in for the custody of the children last May. I received a summons by registered mail to appear in court at the courthouse, Panama City, at 2:30 June 4, 1962, or be held in contempt of court. This is the way these courts operate. I had a complaint from a Ralph V. Barnett out of Pensacola, Florida, who I later found out is a professional dealer in children and was the same one who bought my wife's baby I told you about before. He wanted the custody of my three children and my stepdaughter so he could put them up for adoption. They did not send me a copy of the complaint. I sent in a petition for an injunction against this, charging everything I could think of: bill of attainder, due process of law, and slavery. I did not know his address, so I sent his copy to the state attorney general. If you would like to have a copy, I will send you one. The court gave me a stay until whatever time it takes the Supreme Court to review my case. The welfare department wrote and asked me to sign release papers on my children. I refused. Now they will not write me at all. I do not intend to let anyone take my children away from me, and I will fight it every way I know how. I hope to be able to get my children into a home someplace somehow until I am able to take care of them myself. I believe, although I am a convict and ex-convict, that I have the rights to have children the same as anyone else. Also, I have the rights to ADC, Aid to Dependent Children, and vocational training under the Social Security laws the same as anyone else. Outside of numerous times of arrest, some for investigation, others for compromised convictions, all of the foregoing statements have been true and can stand the any kind of investigation. I am not proud of this biography. I hope that it may help you in preparing this case. I am sorry I could not write better. I have done the best I could. I have no illusions about law and courts, or the people who are involved in them. I have read the complete history of law ever since the Romans first started writing them down and before the laws of religions. I believe that each era finds an improvement in law, each year brings something new for the benefit of mankind. Maybe this will be one of those small steps forward. In the past 35 years, I have seen great advancement in courts, in penal servitude. Thank you for reading all of this. Please try to believe that all I want now from life is the chance for the love of my children, the only real love I have ever had. Sincerely yours, Clarence Earl Gideon. Chapter 6. The question is very simple. I requested the court to appoint me attorney, and the court refused. So Gideon had written to the Supreme Court in support of his claim that the Constitution entitled the poor man charged with crime to have a lawyer at his side. Most Americans would probably have agreed with him. To even the best-informed person unfamiliar with the law, it seemed inconceivable in the year 1962 that the Constitution would allow a man to be tried without a lawyer because he could not afford one. But the question was really as far from simple as it could imaginably be. Behind it there was a long history, a history that until recently had seemed resolutely opposed to Gideon's claim, but now had started to turn and move in his direction. The question that Gideon presented could not be resolved without reference to issues that had been fought over by judges and statesmen and political philosophers, issues going to the nature of our constitutional system and to the role played in it by the Supreme Court. We have come to take it for granted in this country that courts, especially the Supreme Court, have the power to review the actions of governors, legislators, even presidents, and set them aside as unconstitutional. But this power of judicial review, as it is called, has been given to judges in few other countries, and nowhere at any time to the extent that our history has confided it in the Supreme Court. In the guise of legal questions, there come to the Supreme Court many of the most fundamental and divisive issues of every era, issues which judges in other lands would never dream of having to decide. The consequences are great for court and country. For the justices, power means responsibility. A responsibility the more weighty because the Supreme Court so often has the last word. Deciding cases is never easy, but a judge may sleep more soundly after sentencing a man to death, or invalidating a president's seizure of the nation's steel mills, if he knows there is an appeal to a higher court. Justices of the Supreme Court do not have that luxury. "We are not final because we are infallible," Justice Jackson wrote, "but we are infallible only because we are final." Men who know their own fallibility may find it hard to bear the burden of final decision. A few months before the Supreme Court agreed to hear Gideon's case, Justice Charles Evans Whitaker retired after only 5 years on the court, explaining candidly that he found the strain of its work too great. He told friends that when he wrote an opinion, he felt as if he were carving his words into granite. Other men may not be bothered by judicial power, may indeed revel in it. But the existence of power so great inevitably raises questions. Is it consistent with democracy to let 9 men, appointed for life and directly answerable to no constituency, make ultimate decisions about the direction of our society? How free should a judge feel to set above the will of the people's elected representatives the principles that he finds in the Constitution? How does he find them, given the Constitution's vague words and the conflicting interpretations of them by judges of the past? The very legitimacy of judicial review has been questioned repeatedly from the time the Supreme Court first held a federal statute unconstitutional in Marbury v. Madison in 1803. The Jeffersonians accused John Marshall of usurpation. Liberals said the same of the court in the 1930s, and revisionist historians of that day tried to prove that it really had not been given the power of judicial review. Today, the epithets come from extremists of the right, disaffected by the court's decisions on individual liberty and racial equality. Scholarly opinion has long since dismissed the charge that judicial review was illicitly imported into our system by John Marshall or anyone else. The Constitution does not explicitly provide for its enforcement by the federal courts, but the text, including the grant of jurisdiction over cases arising under the Constitution, indicates that expectation. The records of the Philadelphia Convention of 1787 point the same way. At least a substantial number of the delegates assumed that the Supreme Court would pass on the constitutionality of state and federal acts that came before it in lawsuits. The delegates, in fact, considered a proposal to go further and have the court share the president's veto power in a council of revision, but that suggestion was rejected on the ground that the court already had a sufficient check by its power to declare laws unconstitutional. The very conception of a written constitution binding on governments as well as citizens, the great American contribution to political history, presupposed some institution to enforce the rules. Theoretically, that could have been Congress, but the episodic and political nature of the legislative process would have made that choice doubtful. In fact, we have lived for 175 years with the Supreme Court as the final interpreter of our fundamental law, and our whole system of government is now built on that assumption. Justice Jackson, no starry-eyed admirer of judicial review, wrote in 1954, "The real strength of the position of the court is probably in its indispensability to government under a written constitution. It is difficult to see how the provisions of a 150-year-old written document can have much vitality if there is not some permanent institution to translate them into current commands." But if the issue of legitimacy is foreclosed, there remain very live questions of when and how the Supreme Court should exercise its great power to nullify what other branches of government have done. These questions have been the subject of a fierce and unending debate among commentators and among the justices themselves. The opposing positions can best be summarized in terms of the two uncommonly able and determined justices who led the debate for a generation, Felix Frankfurter and Hugo L. Black. Justice Frankfurter's motto was judicial self-restraint. He counseled judges to defer to Congress and the states, even where their actions seemed unwise. to be cautious in reading prohibitions into the Constitution, to respect history, to balance against the interest of the individual the interest of society. Justice Frankfurter warned that relying too much on judges to protect our freedoms sapped the strength of democracy by distracting attention from the political forum where unwise policies should be corrected. He felt the court was often less equipped to deal with a problem than expert administrators or politicians closer to the public will. He was motivated also by a deep concern for the Supreme Court as an institution, a fear that it might destroy itself if it pressed its power too far. He and others remembered the 1930s, when a self-willed court tried to stand against history by stopping urgent economic and social measures, and thus brought itself to the brink of drastic reform, reform which it avoided only by a political change of course. Not that Justice Frankfurter never found state or federal action unconstitutional. His vote to invalidate school segregation, his concern for the freedom of commerce from state barriers, and his careful scrutiny of police behavior and of state assistance to religion all testify to his acceptance of the court's role as enforcer of the Constitution. But right up to his retirement in 1962, his opinions preached judicial caution, self-examination, and restraint. Since then, his restraining role has been carried on by others, especially his friend Justice John Marshall Harlan, who, in a notable speech in 1963, criticized what he called the cosmic view of the judicial function, the idea that all deficiencies in our society which have failed of correction by other means should find a cure in the courts. Justice Black, by contrast, has emphasized the duty of judges to preserve individual liberty, and has argued that excessive deference to other branches of government amounts to abdication of that responsibility. In the Black view, the framers of the Constitution made the decision to protect individuals from governmental repression, so a judge should not feel timid or self-conscious about doing so. Particularly obnoxious to Justice Black is the Frankfurter thesis that the court must balance individual interests against the needs of government and uphold any reasonable governmental course of action. Justice Black argues that this weighing and balancing of what is reasonable leaves judges too much at large. He looks to history and finds definite rules in the Constitution, absolutes, as he has called them. His favorite example is the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press. To Justice Black, as he has put it, no law means no law. Thus, he has gone much farther in finding violations of the First Amendment than almost any other justice, past or present. He has argued in dissent that no government has the power to censor obscenity. And he has repeatedly dissented from decisions upholding federal action against the Communist Party and its members, decisions in which the majority found the injury to free speech outbalanced by the need of society to protect itself against an international conspiracy. Sometimes the debate between Justices Black and Frankfurter, or between the schools of thought they represent, has seemed abstract, more words than real ideas. No one, not even a Supreme Court justice, is always perfectly logical in applying his own theories, so it is dangerous to build too many expectations on stated judicial philosophies. Justice Frankfurter, for example, was willing, when Justice Black was not, to strike down wiretapping as unconstitutional and to forbid the use of state funds for parochial school buses. But for purposes of the Gideon case, the general difference in the Black and Frankfurter approaches was a relevant, inescapable consideration. As Abe Fortas began to think about the case in the summer of 1962, before Justice Frankfurter's retirement, it was clear to him that overruling Betts v. Brady would not come easily to Justice Frankfurter or others of his view. This was true not only because of their judicial philosophy in general, but because of the way they had applied it on specific matters. One of these was the question of precedent. In most matters, it is more important that the applicable rule of law be settled than that it be settled right. Justice Brandeis thus succinctly stated the basic reason for stare decisis. the judicial doctrine of following precedents. In literal translation, the Latin words mean to stand by what has been decided. Anglo-American law is built on the expectation that courts generally will follow what they have said in the past. On that assumption, contracts are signed, wills made, lives planned. But stare decisis is not an iron rule in the courts of this country as it is in England. Justice Brandeis went on, "But in cases involving the federal constitution, where correction through legislative action is practically impossible, this court has often overruled its earlier decisions. The court bows to the lessons of experience and the force of better reasoning." While constitutional cases do present the special considerations mentioned by Brandeis, the court has not in fact restricted to that area its willingness to re-examine past decisions. More than almost any court, it looks beneath precedents for the policy they represent. It might be said to be minding the caustic words of Justice Holmes. "It is revolting to have no better reason for a rule of law than that so it was laid down in the time of Henry IV. It is still more revolting if the grounds upon which it was laid down have vanished long since, and the rule simply persists from blind imitation of the past." Approximately 100 times in its history, the Supreme Court has overruled a prior decision. That is often enough, but overruling has not by any means become a routine step to be taken casually. Certainty and repose in the law still have their appeal. Changes of mind on the part of the court have been met by strong dissent by, among others, Justice Frankfurter. Justice Frankfurter joined in the most famous of recent overruling cases, the school segregation decision of 1954, which abandoned the separate but equal doctrine laid down in 1896. He was not, therefore, unyieldingly attached to the doctrine of stare decisis. But his instinct was to give great weight to the demands of continuity with the past in the law. A 1958 law review study showed that Justice Frankfurter had dissented 13 times from decisions overruling prior cases. Abe Fortas would have to produce compelling reasons to overcome the respect for precedent felt by Justice Frankfurter and others sharing his view. Justice Black, by contrast, felt much freer to turn from past doctrine. In 1958, for example, he unhesitatingly urged the court, in dissent, to abandon 150 years of decisions holding that jury trials were not required in prosecutions for contempt of court. He was unlikely to feel bound by what he considered an erroneous past interpretation of the Constitution. Another issue between Justices Black and Frankfurter cut even deeper than stare decisis and closer to Gideon's case. This was their attitude toward federalism, the independence of the states in our federal system of government. The relationship of the federal government to the states was a central concern of the men who wrote the Constitution. They created a remarkable political structure which made Americans subject to two sovereignties, state and nation. To the states was reserved power over the ordinary affairs of men as they appeared in the 18th century, birth, marriage, death, business, crime. To the federal government went control over interstate commerce, foreign relations, war, and other matters necessarily of national scope. By thus dividing governmental power, the framers sought to lessen the dangers of centralized authority, which they had seen become tyranny in the hands of English kings. They also succeeded in giving us what John Quincy Adams called the most complicated government on the face of the earth. Sorting out the complications has been the job of the Supreme Court. From the beginning, the court has been faced with lawsuits requiring it to draw the boundaries of power between state and nation. At first, the great cases tended to raise questions of the extent of the federal government's power. Did the Constitution authorize Congress to charter a bank? That was the question Marshall decided in 1819 in McCulloch v. Maryland, and his answer in favor of the federal government permanently enlarged its domain. In the 20th century, events have transformed the federal-state issues that come before the court. The growth of the national economy and the emergence of the United States as a world power have inevitably made us more a nation and have necessarily increased federal authority. The Supreme Court tried for a time to stand against that current, holding in New Deal days that Congress had no power under the Constitution to deal with the economic crisis in the country's coal mines or farms, but in 1937 it gave up that attempt. The main arena of controversy today is not the extent of congressional power, but the limitations placed by the Constitution on state governmental action. State officials use the phrase states' rights. By that, they mean the right to handle such matters as race relations and the criminal law as they wish, without restraint by the federal Constitution. The imposing of restraints on state action has evoked great resentment on the part of many state officials, judges not least. In 1958, the Conference of State Chief Justices approved a committee report excoriating the Supreme Court for what was termed an overall tendency to press the extension of federal power and press it rapidly. The report did not deal with the issue of racial segregation, although many thought that was its real inspiration. It put major critical emphasis on Supreme Court decisions laying down minimal guarantees of fairness in criminal proceedings. The Chief Justice's report was no scholarly contribution to the debate about the role of the Supreme Court. It passed over significant areas in which the modern court has significantly enlarged state power, notably the power to tax and regulate the economy. But it did indicate how much emotion may arise over issues of federalism and, most interestingly, in relation to Gideon's case, over the right of the states to run their criminal law without worrying about uniform national standards. For Gideon was asking the Supreme Court to impose on the 50 states a uniform rule of criminal procedure, the universal requirement that counsel be supplied to poor criminal defendants. And that claim inevitably clashed with the belief that diversity among the states was as important a theme in the Constitution as individual rights, a belief held by, among others, Felix Frankfurter. Whatever inconveniences and embarrassments may be involved, Justice Frankfurter wrote in 1958, they are the price we pay for our federalism, for having our people amenable to, as well as served and protected by, two governments. As a strong believer in the independence of the states, Justice Frankfurter was reluctant to impose new restraints on them, even in the name of individual liberty. Justice Black was always much readier to cut through the duality and enlarge protections for the individual against any government. The contrast in views was graphically illustrated in the case of Alphonse Bartkus, the Illinois prisoner who had been tried by a federal and then an Illinois jury for the same bank robbery. Justice Frankfurter, writing for the Supreme Court majority that upheld the second prosecution, said the result was commanded by our system of dual sovereignties. The greatest self-restraint is necessary, he said in the opinion, when that federal system yields results with which a court is in little sympathy. Justice Black viewed the case not as a problem in governmental structure, but as one of fairness to Alphonse Bartkus. The court apparently takes the position, he said in dissent, that a second trial for the same act is somehow less offensive if one of the trials is conducted by the federal government and the other by a state. Looked at from the standpoint of the individual who is being prosecuted, this notion is too subtle for me to grasp. Underlying the Bartkus case was one of the great issues of federalism, a subject of conflict in the Supreme Court for nearly a century. This was the question of what provisions in the Constitution's Bill of Rights, if any, applied to the states. The average American would probably have thought that Bartkus's second trial by the state of Illinois was barred by the Double Jeopardy Clause of the Fifth Amendment. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. But that clause had been held to cover only federal, not state, criminal proceedings. The Bill of Rights is the name collectively given to the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, all proposed by the first Congress of the United States in 1789 and ratified in 1791. The first 8 contain the guarantees of individual liberty with which we are so familiar: freedom of speech, press, religion and assembly, protection for the privacy of the home, assurance against double jeopardy and compulsory self-incrimination, the right to counsel and to trial by jury, freedom from cruel and unusual punishments. At the time of their adoption, it was universally agreed that these 8 amendments limited only the federal government and its processes. Fear of the new central government had been the reason for their adoption, some states even refusing to ratify the Constitution until assured that the federal government would be restrained by a Bill of Rights. James Madison, who, as a member of the House, was a principal draftsman of the amendments, actually included one to guarantee individual rights against the states. It read, "No state shall infringe the right of trial by jury in criminal cases, nor the rights of conscience, nor the freedom of speech, or of the press." Madison thought it the most valuable amendment in the whole list, seeing more danger of abuse by the state governments than by the government of the United States. But the Senate rejected his proposal, and the original Bill of Rights limited only federal action. In 1833, in the case of Barron v. Baltimore, Chief Justice Marshall wrote the Common Understanding into law with a specific decision that the Bill of Rights did not cover the states. There matters stood until the 14th Amendment became part of the Constitution in 1868. A product of the Civil War, it was specifically designed to prevent abuse of individuals by state governments. Section 1 provided, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." Soon the claim was advanced that this section had been designed by its framers to incorporate and apply to the states all the provisions of the first 8 amendments. This theory of wholesale incorporation of the Bill of Rights has been adopted by one or more Supreme Court justices from time to time, but never a majority. The climactic battle came in 1947 in Adamson v. California, when 4 justices read the 14th Amendment as including the entire Bill of Rights, Justices Black, Douglas, Frank Murphy, and Wiley B. Rutledge. That 5-4 defeat was the high water mark of the contention that the first 8 amendments were incorporated in toto in the 14th. But if wholesale incorporation has been rejected, the Supreme Court has used the 14th Amendment to apply provisions of the Bill of Rights to the states selectively. The vehicle has been the clause assuring individuals due process of law. The court has said that state denial of any right deemed fundamental by society amounts to a denial of due process and hence violates the 14th Amendment. For example, freedom of speech is protected by the 1st Amendment against abridgment by Congress. If a state abridges free speech, the court regards that freedom as so central to human liberty that it finds a violation of the 14th Amendment's due process guarantee. The historical process by which provisions of the original Bill of Rights have thus been applied to state as well as federal action was described by Justice Benjamin N. Cardozo as a process of absorption of those rights, implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. It is an ironic note that Justice Black, who had just come on the court, joined the 1937 Cardozo opinion advancing that formula. As his own philosophy developed, he rejected the absorption idea, feeling that it left judges too much at large, and found greater certainty in the thesis of wholesale incorporation. But absorption has been and remains the accepted process. The difficult question has been which provisions of the first 8 amendments to absorb. At first, the court was most reluctant to read any into the due process clause of the 14th. By the year 1900, the justices had refused to apply virtually every guarantee in the Bill of Rights to the states. As late as 1922, the court said that the protections of the First Amendment, of free speech, press, religion, and assembly, did not apply to the states. But it is one thing to slam the door of the Due Process Clause, and another to keep it shut, Professor Paul A. Freund has written. In 1925, the court changed its mind and said free speech was so fundamental that a state could not deny it without denying due process of law and violating the 14th Amendment. The other freedoms of the First Amendment followed. The court has been much more reluctant to apply to the states the guarantees of fair criminal procedure in the First Eight Amendments. It evidently felt, over many